We heard in Pam's reading today, Jesus is teaching us how to pray. It gives us, in the scriptures we heard, this raw material for something that comes together as the Lord's Prayer. It's the prayer that we say when we celebrate the Lord's Supper around this table. And it's a mashup of several of the gospel's instructions on how to pray. Jesus starts his instructions on how to pray by telling the disciples what not to do. Don't be like the Gentiles. When we hear this, we need to remember that there are no Gentile Christians yet. There are no Christians at all. Jesus is talking about pagans, people who spend their time trying to convince a piece of wood to fulfill their desires, to heal their sick, to help grow their crops, and to help their businesses flourish. As you can imagine, it takes quite a bit of work to get a piece of wood to answer your prayers. A lot of commitment. When you pray, don't babble on like the Gentiles who think that they can speak more and more and they're more likely to be heard. I love the Greek word for this, bladalogio. I love it because it sounds like what it is, right? Bladalogio, bladalogio. These are babblers, people who speak words probably very loudly in the hopes of attracting attention from what are surely reluctant gods. If you're following Jesus around and wondering how you are supposed to pray, you might be taking your cue from these Gentiles and their many fancy words babbling about. And this is concerning enough that Jesus takes time to talk to his disciples about what they've seen. Why is that? He isn't concerned about the method of prayer per se. Jews of the day frequently use liturgies and the Psalms to pray. Praying something like that isn't a problem. Jesus' concern is about what this pagan Gentile way of praying says about the God behind it. Do you all remember the Whos down in Whoville? Little tiny people who lived on the head of a clover? If you know this story, Horton Hears a Who from Dr. Seuss, you may remember an elephant named Horton with exceptional hearing who happens to hear these microscopic Whos as they are crying out for help on top of this clover floating by. And to keep them from being destroyed, all the Whos must band together to attract the attention of their reluctant overlords. "We are here, we are here, we are really, really here," they chant over and over again until they're finally heard and recognized. I don't know if Theodore Seuss Geisel had Jesus' exhortation not to pray like the Gentiles in mind when he wrote this children's story, but it certainly does the job of illustrating what Jesus is warning against. We are not floating about in the cosmos, a great power in the universe blissfully unaware of our existence, in need of being reminded of our lives by our loud and boisterous prayers. So don't be like them, since your Father knows what you need before you ask. Jesus tells his disciples the opposite is true. God is so close, so near, so invested in our lives that our prayers actually take place with inside of God's life. When we interact with God in prayer, we're doing so from the inside, which is why it's a silly exercise to spend your time trying to attract God's attention. And then Jesus gives this rough outline of how to pray in light of this remarkable change of perspective. Start by positioning your prayer here, from where God is in control of history, working things out in the minutiae of the world, not distant from it. God is in charge of all things, intimately involved in creation. Our Father in heaven, your name is holy. And then statements. Your kingdom be established. be firmed up in our midst. Your desires, your intentions for the righting of wrong, the reign of justice, let it come to pass. And this is when we start to talk about our own needs from here. That's what centers the rest of the prayer, the next petitions. You'll notice that these prayers don't cover everything. These prayers are all about us and about our needs. There's no talk of praying for others or holding to the light the concerns of the world. Jesus isn't giving us the final authoritative prayer for all time. He's teaching us that in prayer we discover that we belong to God and that all our needs are expressed within the vast and unending care of God in creation. Somehow, miraculously, the God who sets stars and planets in their orbits, who counts the deer as they are born each year, the God who holds up the tides of the earth, is concerned about you. You. About your needs. About your food and your fears, about your doubts, your forgiveness. You within the vastness of the universe, the expansive universe. About you. To emphasize this point, Matthew actually jumps from Hebrew, in the formal language of the temple, to Aramaic when he talks about the outline of this prayer. This was the everyday language of the people. It was the language you spoke around the dinner table, the one you whispered to your children as they went to bed at night, the one you argued in the marketplace and used to barter down whatever you needed. The purpose of prayer isn't to use your fanciest speech and your loudest voice. That simply isn't needed. I suspect we all need this reminder that we are not simply floating about in a cosmic soup. All true prayer is a work of grace, writes Herbert McCabe. It is the initiative from the Father drawing us into communion with the Son. Prayer is a sort of intensification of the divine life in you. It's recognition of the grace that has always been intended for you from this moment that your prayer has been answered. Prayer lets us see that the whole business of creation is to show love. Prayer is not talking God into something that you need. Prayer is the expression of you within God's life. Herbert McCabe also tells the story of a pastor he knew, and the pastor was deeply disappointed in himself for praying for the mechanical well-being of his airplane as it took off down the runway. To the pastor, it seemed juvenile. This kind of prayer is not the kind offered by dignified adults. And that, writes McCabe, is the problem in a nutshell. We don't approach God as people who've worked out what are appropriate and inappropriate prayers, as though we've sorted out the kinds of things we ought to bring to God. Remember the first request, the first thing Jesus tells us to pray for? What was it? For food. Right. Give us the food we need for today. It's the most bodily and simple of all requests. There's nothing sacred or holy about that. It's about what you'll eat tonight for dinner, about the sandwich you'll pack for tomorrow. It's the first offering of the prayer that Jesus instructs us. There's nothing more basic or less dignified than asking God for a bag of chips, which is why I think Jesus puts it right up here up front. Of course, some people don't pray because they don't believe there's anything on the other line. I can't offer you a recipe for belief, only to say that Jesus doesn't think in these terms. There's no line to disconnect. There's only God. There's only God praying within you, and you within the grace of Jesus Christ, an eternal conversation that happens between God and Jesus, into which your prayer is entrance. But it could be that this is also not your hesitation when it comes to prayer. Instead, you may worry that you're praying for the wrong thing, like that pastor on the airplane. Perhaps you think it's too petty to pray about the dog next door barking a little too loudly. Or perhaps your prayers are filled with rage or even violence. Perhaps you think your prayers are beyond what is reasonable, so you keep them to yourself. Instead, you pray for spiritual things, for the good of the dog next door, for patience to endure the governmental incompetence that surrounds you, something pious to endure trials to the end. What if instead you took some time this week to pray for the things you actually want? We've already heard Jesus say that prayer is not about talking loudly to get God's attention, but the rest of the prayer is a teaching too. Instead of being distracted by the frustration and anger of your neighbor's dog, pretending you don't want it to stop, offer it in prayer. Then take some time to see what's springing up there. What is the need behind it? What is the trouble? God is not interested in you guessing at the things you ought to want. God wants you just as you are. It will be hard for you to make any contact with the divine life if you approach prayer as something you ought to be. And if you need any proof that I'm onto something here, you can consult the book of Psalms. In the Bible, there are all sorts of prayers that will raise your eyebrows. They are prayers for violence against enemies, for material prosperity, for your national foes to be ground to dust. And if we look here, we discover that prayer isn't an attempt to conjure up the neatest, cleanest version of ourselves. Prayers are the part of us that wells up from deep terror and profound selfishness. And when God does not answer these prayers, or answers them in a way we do not expect, this is also a part of dwelling deeply in God's life. It's about coming to see ourselves clearly. And when that happens, you discover something. You might come to find you don't actually need to win the lottery, that you are asking for a lot of things you don't need, things that may actually make other people worse off than they already are. You may come to find that your enemy is not actually your enemy, that the problem is more with you, that your fear of loss or your prejudice or your not getting your own way is getting in the way. You may find that you are asking God to make a way where there is no way. Because this is also an answer to prayer, to discover what it is we really need, and then to go about seeing how God answers it. And even now, questions may linger for you. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and every day have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me? Look on me and answer, O Lord. Give light to my eyes, or I will sleep in death. The Psalms offer us prayers like this as well, that we expect God to act on our behalf, and when God doesn't, we are angry and confused at God. There is something true and mysterious and important in saying that somehow God is a part of this too. Not all the prayers that we have going unanswered in our lives are prayers which we would be better off without in the end. Sometimes that is the case, but not always. Sometimes, for all of this about God's eternal love, for God knowing what we need, we are broken apart by illness and separation and addiction and death. Remarkably, We have pages of prayers preserved for us that give us permission to be angry at God about this. I do not have answers for the times when the prayers you prayed, when your good prayers, did not come about the way that you had hoped. But I can tell you that your anger and your grief is directed towards a God who loves you, who can take it, who receives it, and who weeps with you. We know this, because once Jesus, God incarnate, prayed one of these prayers to his Father on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? Many psalms that begin in this anger do not resolve in triumph. They resolve themselves in hope. They are a reminder to me that all of it, praise and anger, my deepest fears and my worst version of myself, which may indeed just be the unmasked version of myself as I really am, every part of it, all of it happens within God's life. Prayer is simply a concentration of hope that offers before us this opportunity to enter into a truth that animates creation. No matter where you go, God goes with you to the very end of the age. Amen.